You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Montauk ingoa. E whakarongo ana koe ki te Wire maurunga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, te rā te kaumārima o painga whāwha. No mai, haere mai. Kia ora, you're tuned into the Thursday Wire on 95VFM with me, Justin Wong. For today, rāpere Thursday the 15th of April. And this is the Thursday Wire. I hope you all have a very lovely week so far. Still, I'm on my own in the studio with no producers, but I'm sure this is still a good show. If I can A, because coming up on the show, the Ministry of Health has released a proposal for its smoke-free 2025 target and action on smoking and health, or ASH. Shares Director Deborah Hart talked to me about this. As usual, Radio Adelaide Zoe Canandes updates us on what's happening across the ditch on our neighbourhood watch, while International Desk is back to talk about Japan as the Japanese government is planning to release 1 million tonnes of wastewater from the Fukushima Daiichi power station into the Pacific Ocean. As usual, he aha ofakado. Let me know what you think about all of this. Tukapatuhi mai, the text number is 5395, or if you want to talk to me, call me on 309-3879. As usual, kua e ware ware e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano hei pakihere roki roki maranga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website. And to get back to the earlier shows that you missed. I tēnā wā tonu. Now, let's talk about smoking.
The Wire.
The government has released a proposed action plan to reach its smoke-free goal in 2025. The plan has five focus areas, including reducing the availability, appeal, addictiveness, and affordability of cigarettes. And the ministry proposed in the document that the government should set a minimum price for tobacco, license sellers to sell cigarettes and vaping products, limit the types of shops that can sell tobacco, and license tobacco retailers based on population size and density. The same document also said flavoured filters like those you found in methanol cigarettes should be banned, and a smoke-free generation policy that means gradually increasing the legal smoking age. Action on Smoking or Health, or ASH, has been advocating for smoke-free by 2025, and I asked its director Deborah Hart on her thoughts of this proposal.
Well, we welcome the plan. It's really great to see the government putting out a plan that will hopefully get us the smoke-free 2025.
Right, but I just wanted to go through some of the details of the proposed plan, because some of them might, honestly saying, it's quite prohibitionist. It's quite leaning on prohibition, like reducing nicotine, producing flavored filters, mandating certain license. Only sort of stores can only sell tobacco and even vape products.
Yep.
We saw prohibitionist policies being applied on drugs and alcohol in the past, and that didn't work very well in New Zealand or in other countries. Why do you think it would work on cigarettes here?
If it was going to be a total prohibition, I would agree with you. But what the government is wanting to do is to optimise less harmful products and then lessen the impact of this uniquely harmful product, which is smoked cigarettes. So we now have vapes in this country, and vapes are a much less harmful product, but they deliver nicotine just like cigarettes deliver nicotine. And people smoke cigarettes for the nicotine, but of course they die from the smoke, and vapes don't have smoke, so one of the reasons that they're a lot less harmful. So what the government is trying to do is put the policy set in there so that there are choices available for people who have got a dependence on that nicotine. It's not like they can't have anything, but to point them towards the less harmful product.
Okay. Don't you think banning everything, every available tobacco product would cause an black market to emerge for cigarette products? Or maybe shouldn't the government focus on a more health-based or education approach on smoke-free?
A few things to say about that. First of all, I don't read this proposal as banning smoked products. They're talking about reducing availability and making the products less addictive and less appealing. Yes, there is a concern about the black market, and certainly there has been a black market with cigarettes. I see that the government is wanting to strengthen compliance and enforcement activity. And the last thing to say is one of the things that the government is intending to do is to increase investment in helping people to quit and to help them come to the decision that they shouldn't start in the first place. I suppose what I'm saying to you is this is a package. It's not just one thing. If it was one thing, it certainly wouldn't work. It needs a number of things. And the things that have to be done absolutely immediately is to help people switch to less harmful products, mainly vaping, to help communities with community-led initiatives, and to really invest in mass and social media campaigns that we know are so successful. Those are the immediate things that need to happen, and then all of these other things that the government's talking about follow on from that.
Right, but a lot of these initiatives, like setting a minimum price, seems to impact more on poor people, like dairy owners, because not being able to sell tobacco, looks like only much more rich people can afford cigarettes now. Do you agree that these proposals seems to be a little bit discriminatory towards poor people?
Not really. I think what you have to understand is that the wealthiest among us are already at smoke-free. Really, the people who are really impacted so adversely by smoking are the poorest in our society. So what we need to be doing is really aiming all of our measures at those communities. We have what was discriminatory is that our measures previously to help people get to smoke free were really aimed at people are better off in our society, but that's really discriminatory. And we've really got to, as an equity issue, get all of us to smoke free so that we can all be healthier. And your point about the minimum pricing, I would agree with you that if it was that alone, it is very hard for people. So you cannot just put the pricing up and then leave people nowhere to go with what is a very hard dependency. And most people want to give up cigarette smoking and have tried numerous times. So you can't just put the price up and just leave them. what you have to do is help them find a less harmful alternative and help them in a way that it's responsive to their own needs. And I see the plan as doing that. We will wait with bated breath to see if on the 20th of May the government puts its money where its mouth is with the budget.
Right, and just being looking at this document, how confident are you is this country going to achieve smoke-free by 2021 if the proposals in this document is being implemented?
Well, this is really an ambitious plan, really very ambitious. And we need an ambitious plan because we're running out of time to get to the smoke-free 2025 target. If the government does freeze immediately and then follows on with these other things, we will get there. And the three things are supporting communities with culturally appropriate and scaled-up initiatives, encouraging less harmful alternatives such as vaping, and investing in media campaigns to promote smoke-free. Those things, if they now together with all of the things that are in the plan, we have a really good opportunity to get to smoke-free 2025. And by the way, I should tell you that 12 people are going to die of cigarette smoking today, another 12 tomorrow, and another day after this. It's urgent business. If we were having 12 people dying today of COVID, I can assure you we would all be acting very fast. This is a major public health issue that we need to deal with at the moment, and it's great to see the government doing that.
And that was Deborah Hart, who is the director from ASH. If we just have a call up during the interview about this story, the caller said we, instead of licensing retailers to sell tobacco, only individuals who get a concession card should be able to purchase tobacco only. Let me know what you think as well. The text number is 5395 and the number is 309-3879. It's 17 past noon. We'll be going on a quick break. You're listening to 95BFM.
Words I wanna hear it, only when I cry my tears. Congratulations, miss. You're officially pregnant. Great work. Now, if you ask me, my advice for young mothers-to-be...
Tell me, doctor.
Go see the Vales in concert. They're performing their iconic sophomore album, Nux Vomica, in its entirety for the very first time. And I imagine it'll be most instructive for you.
The Vales, Nux Vomica, live. If you want to win yourself a couple of tickets, then you know what to do. Tune in to 95BFM all this week and keep your B-card handy. 95BFM presents The Vales, performing Nux Vomica, live at the Power Station with support from Silicon. May 1st, sold out. May 2nd, tickets on sale now. Go to banishedmusic.com.
Tired of ye old traffic? Freed e-scooters are giving away a 09 e-scooter. Lightweight for easy portability on the bus or train. 600 watt motor and disc brakes. The 09 is perfect for medium distance commutes. Just come down to Freed on West Haven Drive, test ride one of our e-scooters, and you could be in to win. Freed electric scooters. Fun, safe and easy to ride. Find out more at freedpev.co.nz. Promotion ends April 30th.
The majestic wonders of the ancient world. The pyramids at Giza. The cunning riddle of the Sphinx.
But now one ancient secret has been solved by the good people at Bread and Butter.
Their ancient grain sourdough uses heritage cereals, Khorasan, spelt and sorghum, and follows the age-old method of sourdough fermentation dating back to ancient Egypt. So it's great for your gut, tastes delicious, and is better for the planet. Ancient grain sourdough at Bread and Butter, Grey Lynn, Ponsonby, and the Coast Plaza in Whangaparoa. Order online at breadandbutter.nz.
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11 p.m., only on 95BFM.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
You're still listening to The Wire on 95BFM. And before we move on, just want to say the proposal on Smoke-Free 2050 is open for consultation by the Ministry of Health. It will be online until 5pm May 31st. So if you have any thoughts on the proposal, do let the Ministry know. Now, let's see what's happening overseas.
Where in the world is Justin Wong? It's Overseas Experience, your international news update on 95BFM.
Yes, Japan has said they will release 1 million tonnes of wastewater, or the equivalent of 500 standard Olympic swimming pools, from the Daiichi nuclear power station in Fukushima, which was destroyed during the March 2011 earthquakes, into the Pacific Ocean over the next 2 years. The power plant's operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, said the water will be filtered twice before being released into the sea, but environmental organisations like Greenpeace and neighbouring countries like China and South Korea have spoken against it. And to understand the science behind this, I spoke to Dr. David Krofchek, who was a senior lecturer in physics at the University of Auckland, about this. I come what my first question on this would be, for the listeners who really don't know how a nuclear power plant works, why do you need water in a nuclear power plant?
A nuclear power plant, well, as I tell my students, is just a very fancy way to boil water. And you need the water to produce steam, because you get heat from the nuclear fission reactions in the nuclear reactor. And that steam then drives turbines, which generate the electricity. So it's essentially an incredibly expensive way to boil water, and the heat coming also is then recycled the water is recycled, it goes back in, and you have this continuous loop to keep the nuclear reactor cool, you know, at a constant temperature. But as the water heats, you generate more steam, and it is a closed loops of water that goes around, and that's the water that is useful for cooling the nuclear reactor and taking the heat from that nuclear reactor and transferring it to steam and turning that steam via turbine into electric power.
Right, but in the case of what happened at Daiichi Power Plant in Fukushima, so why? What caused the water that's being used to cool the power plant? What caused it to be so radioactive?
Yeah, this is what I just described was a normal working nuclear power plant, and in Fukushima, of course, this was a tidal wave generated by an enormous earthquake, which overcame the border defenses of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plants. This water is essentially when there were the generators that did pump the water around in normal times, mm-hmm. Were put out of action by the flood from the tidal wave, and that way there was no water to take away the heat from the nuclear reactor. So the people on site started pouring at the beginning seawater into the reactor to try to keep the reactor from overheating and melting, which they're only partially successful at doing, as the reactor did melt on the floor. But that is the kind of water that we're talking about. There's extra water that's been used to try to keep the reactor cool. Now it's cooled down, but there's groundwater from the extra damage from the earthquake, and it normally flows under the reactors. And this groundwater now has mixed in with the nuclear reactor that is now open because of a melt-through in the nuclear reactor. And so you get this radioactive groundwater. It picks up nuclear fission particles from the nuclear reactor, and it would normally take it out to sea, because that's just what groundwater does. It would take it out to sea. So the Japanese engineers have been trying to collect this groundwater. First of all, they try to divert it with very fancy high-tech ground freezing methods to try to build an underground frozen wall.
Sorry to interrupt. Is this what the Japanese authorities called the quote-unquote ice wall?
Yes, that's the ice wall. And so they froze down a number of meters to try to divert. And it did work. It reduced about 400 tons of water per day down to about 150 or 140 tons of water. But there's still 140 tons of groundwater flowing through the opened nuclear reactor cavity. And this water is still getting into the ocean, but there are pumps which try to remove the remaining water from the reactor, and then this water is the water containing the nuclear fission products, cesium and strontium and all kind, and about 50 other varieties of atomic elements that come from uranium splitting in half and getting 50 different kind of nuclear fission products. And these things are trying to be filtered out of that pumped groundwater. And this is what is stored after the pumping process and then the filtering process. This is what is being stored in 1,000 tanks, each carrying 1,000 tons of water. So you've got a million tons of water, essentially, in water tanks, which have been nominally passed through the filter one time. And this is the water that the Japanese want to, in I think a couple of years, release back into the ocean. Now, this filtering technique from this to pick up the groundwater and remove the nuclear particles from the nuclear fission may not have worked as well the first time around. Mm-hmm. And I've read some number that like 70% of the water will have to go through a second round because the removal wasn't as efficient as people hoped. And I'm kind of surprised. I think they should have kept a running tally and a running check on how efficient this process was. Or if they did, we don't know about it. Anyway, there will be another round of removal of radioactive particulates, normal nuclear fission product particulates, and we don't want to let those go into the water because they have long half-lives, particularly strontium and cesium, which are able to be absorbed by the human body, and they can end up in your thyroid or into your bones, and they then take up long-term residency there. So we want to specifically get those two, strontium-90 and cesium-137, removed. And it will take maybe it looks like a second filtering attempt to get much more effective removal of these radioactive fission products removed from the water in the storage tanks that are on site.
Right, that's quite interesting. Much more of a technical question, though. How does the filter system remove all those harmful elements from the water?
Yeah, this is something called the Advanced Liquid Processing System called ALPS, and I've been trying to figure out the technology here. It's a series of filters through which the chemical, the isotopes react and get absorbed on the filters. So the process essentially is squeezing the water through the filters many, many times, and at the coming out
so
the other
end. So it's kind of like a huge chemical sponge.
Well, it is. You could call it a chemical sponge, yeah. And that sponge usually worked very well for small scale use. And I thought this would be a great solution for the dangerous radionuclides. And I'm kind of surprised that they have to refilter. I don't know the exact numbers of how much radiation was actually removed the first time through, but I'm kind of surprised that they have to redo this a second time. But that's the only information that I can find. Mm-hmm. On the open literature.
Right. Because the Japanese authorities, and especially Tokyo Electric Power Company, the Tokyo Electric Company, have said only a form of hydrogen known as
tritium.
Tritium will be left in the final product before the water is discharged into the sea. So what actually is tritium?
Oh, tritium is one of the heavy cousins of regular good old hydrogen. So you have one proton and one electron for hydrogen, and you have hydrogen gas. You put two protons together and two electrons, and you can make hydrogen gas. So it's the simplest atomic element we have. And tritium is one of the heavier cousins. So you can have a proton plus one neutron, if you remember high school chemistry, and that will give you deuterium, which is a form of heavy hydrogen. But then tritium is two neutrons and one proton in the nucleus of the tritium atom. And so it's just a very heavy cousin of normal hydrogen. And it has a half-life. It's radioactive. It has a half-life of about 12 years. And I think that is what will end up saving this situation, because the half-life is only 12 years. So after 12 years, half of that tritium will have decayed by natural radiation back to a non-radioactive element.
Mm-hmm. But should we be concerned about tritium? Like, what does it do to marine life or to the human body?
You should always be concerned by radioactive material, especially in large amounts, and especially if that material builds up in certain parts of the body, like builds up, catching being caught in the thyroid, for example, or building up in the bones of the human body. Tritium acts just like water. I mean, it will live inside the human body, but it has a biological half-life as well, meaning it stays within the human body for a certain amount of days before it gets excreted, you know, on average. So it doesn't build up in any one particular part of the body. And the good part is that it, even though the half-life is 12 years, that tritium has a much shorter biological half-life, and I think it might be on the order of days or tens of days that it will leave your body. But really, anything that's radioactive, you don't want to put too much of it in your body, because our bodies are radioactive anyway. Mm-hmm. We have potassium in our bodies and carbon-14 naturally in our bodies, and every time we eat food, we were picking up radioactive carbon-14. And that's being digested and excreted through the human body. So the thing is, you don't want to have too much in one person's body at the same time. If you have low levels, well, this is what we evolved with, low levels of carbon-14 in particular. But the tritium also has a shorter biological half-life, and for long-term problems like this Fukushima, the 12-year half-life will work. It'll be one of the few things in their favor to eliminate the amount of radiation in the water.
Overseas Experience with Justin Wong, only on 95 BFM.
That was indeed International Desk speaking to Dr. David Krofshek about the Japanese government authorities' decision to pump a million tons of nuclear wastewater into the Pacific Ocean from Fukushima. The time is 38 past noon. We'll be going on another break. Stay tuned before we go to Australia.
call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
This week on Neighbourhood Watch, Australia's most decorated soldier, Beam Robert Smith, is under investigation from the Australian Federal Police after a report from Channel 9's 60 Minutes alleged that he buried sensitive material and intimidated a witness in an active war crimes investigation. But we began with Radio Adelaide's Zoe Kernandez on Prime Minister Scott Morrison refusing to apologise to former Australia Post CEO Christine Holgate over allegations of bullying. Here's Zoe. So you want to start this week off by talking about Prime Minister Scott Morrison's refusal to apologise to former Australia Post CEO Christine Holgate.
Yeah, so this is a very interesting story that was just sort of seen come to a head. Christine Holgate was the former Australian Post CEO, so obviously Australia Post is our postal service, and Scott Morrison has refused to apologise to her. He said it was never his intention for his strong language to impact her, and while rejecting sort of her claim of gender-based treatment and bullying in the workplace. So all of this is kind of very much linked to a scandal last year where Christine Holgate gave four executives of Australia Post some watches for their long service. I can't remember the brand of watch, my apologies, but they retailed for about $5,000 each, and she gave them to these executives to honour their hard work. And Australia Post during the pandemic, as I'm sure New Zealand's Postal Service as well, you know, everything changed for them last year. So she gave them these quite expensive watches in order to thank them. She has said that she had $150,000 in the budget in order to give these executives a bonus, but rather she decided to give them watches. This spiraled into somewhat of a scandal, and essentially Christine Holgate is sort of alleging that she was bullied and said it was one of the worst acts of bullying I've ever witnessed. When Scott Morrison last year in Parliament sort of demanded that Christine Holgate was to resign or to leave, Holgate has now come out and she has fronted this inquiry over Australia Post, claiming that she has done nothing wrong. So she faced the inquiry. She was sort of dressed all in white, which was a nod to the suffragette movement here in Australia and around the world. And she has gone on to mention the really serious acts of bullying, and she believes that a lot of what has happened to her has been very gender-based. And I guess why this is, you know, this is a very important story, and her story is very important at any time. But if we currently pair that with the time that we're living through right now, where we're seeing Scott Morrison under fire because of a lot of the recent allegations of what has happened in Parliament House, also things that aren't allegations that we know are true to have happened in Parliament House, like junior MPs masturbating over female MP desks, and his new initiative to create more equitable and safe and less bullying for women in the workplace. If we pair that with that time now, I mean, it's very interesting, and the two don't contrast very well with each other.
Right, but how did Christine Holgate leave her post? Did she resign, or was she eventually forced out?
So Christine Holgate in November 2020 did offer her resignation, stating that she wasn't going to be seeking any financial compensation. And now we're having this subsequent inquiry, and it's found that there's been no identified policy that would support provision of her giving these watches. It's a little bit complicated. She has offered her resignation, and now we're going through this inquiry. She hasn't technically left yet. I think she wants this inquiry to play out first. So she technically is the CEO of Australia Post still, but she has offered her resignation in November last year. And currently what we're seeing this week is that inquiry into those watches go forth. So it's a little bit complicated, but that's where she currently stands.
Okay, moving on to our second topic this week to now the Australian Federal Police is investigating allegations against a former soldier.
Yeah, they are. So there's these fresh investigations into the former soldier, who is one of, I'd say, Australia's most celebrated soldiers. He did receive the Victoria Cross. The Victoria Cross, which is one of the highest awards a soldier can get here in Australia, maybe even the Commonwealth. Apologies if I don't know that. So his name is Ben Robert Smith, and it was alleged, this investigation comes after it was alleged that he buried some really sensitive information in his own backyard, and he attempted to intimidate a witness in an active investigation into war crimes. So the AFP Deputy Commissioner, his name's Ian McCartney, he told the Senate estimates hearing on Wednesday this week that police have reopened this investigation because of these new allegations. He allegedly buried these very sensitive information in a lunchbox. There were US, it was alleged that there were USB sticks containing some very classified information, some reports from SAS missions in Afghanistan, some drone footage, and some photos. And it is also alleged that Robert Smith, sent emails and letters intimidating people he believed would give evidence against him in war crime investigations. This is really, really interesting. I mean, wind back a few years ago, and this Ben Robert Smith was, you know, very celebrated and very honoured and received the Victoria Cross. It'll be really interesting to see where these investigations land and what come of these allegations. I think to see where these investigations land and these allegations, what comes of them.
Right. But did the AFP said anything about the war crimes that was being investigated? Was that already existing for, I think, what's called the Brereton Report, or is it another operation that's being under investigated?
I think it's the same as the investigation that's been reopened. It's been reopened, in a matter of fact, because the Nine Network here in Australia have actually the Nine Network here in Australia have been the ones who have alleged that this is what Robert Smith has done, and the AFP have, you know, opened this investigation into aspects of that media reporting, and they haven't given us too much more information, to be fair. So I don't have quite all the running commentary of the investigation and what it's looking into. We don't know what's on the photos or on the USBs, but we do know that the investigation has been reopened.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
That was indeed Neighbourhood Watch. It's up to 7 to 1 here in Auckland. Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire Marunga Irirangi Pōho. You tuned into the Thursday Wire with me, Justin Wong, on 95 BFM, and we'll be on another break.
The beauty of the fleeting and the ephemeral is so last century.
95BFM's popular shows, features and interviews are available as podcasts on RSS and Apple.
You're listening to Totally Wired, the all-new music show. My name is Jess Fu.
Thanks for stopping by for the 95BFM Kids Show.
Greetings and welcome.
This is the Rhythm Selection.
So this is one for the musical theatre nerds.
Welcome along to Thursday Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry.
And we will let you know about Drive Island, of course.
Never miss out again. Becasts available on Apple Podcasts. Podcast or RSS for whatever podcatcher you're into.
Hakarongo mai, it's Māori words, because he waka eke noa. Kei runga noa apu koe. You're awesome. You're the best.
Hey Bridge, I couldn't find that track you were looking for.
Kei runga noa atu koe, truly.
Nah, I couldn't find it.
But you looked, and that's so beautiful.
Kei runga noa apu koe. You're awesome. You're the best. Māori words, karawhiua, give it a go.
Tinnitus can be defined as
a false perception of a sound in the absence of an acoustic stimulus.
It sounds a bit like this. Otago University is conducting a study to better understand early stage tinnitus. They're asking people who have recently begun to experience tinnitus to complete an online survey to help with their research. If that's you, register now at tinnitus.nz. You'll receive a token of gratitude for your time. That's tinnitus.nz.
Daddy, Daddy, what have you brought me from your travels?
For you, my child, oranges from Spain.
Daddy, Daddy, have you a gift for me?
For you, my sweet, this carved jade badger from the Khotan region of China.
And me, Daddy?
Ah, for my favourite, a white label cameo 12-inch, all the way from the land of the good groove.
This slaps, Papa!
Land of the Good Groove with the legendary Murray Kamek.
It's Murray Kamek.
Who's that lady? Who's that lady? Keep on the
Land of the Good Groove. Every Friday, 1 to 2 p.m., only on 95BFM.
All you wanna be is just a friend of mine, but I know.
That was The Wire.
Koira te hota kakatoa mo tēnei rā, and that's all for the Thursday Wire today, the 15th of April. Nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero me ki mātou mo tēnei rā. Thanks to those who spoke to me today. We've got Dr. David Krofcheck of Auckland University, ASH Director Deborah Hart, and as usual, Radio Adelaide Savi Canandes. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Big thanks to those who tuned in, texted and called in today. We appreciate all of them. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rā wiki. I'm handing you over to Sigrid for the 1-4 now. Enjoy the rest of your week and I'll see you next time. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.